Hello and what is shaking, everybody? Welcome to the Wind Up Podcast. I'm your host, Mike of MTGA Wines, and we are trying to decipher some things about what's going on in the industry, how we're moving forward, where these conversations are taking us. How in the world is the industry adapting to this, I guess, brave new world of, you know, trying to be more transparent, trying to be more communicative and relatable, trying to entice a younger generation to get into wine, but also just kind of the mindset that we seem to just be stuck in. It's going to be kind of a broader kind of episode talking about kind of a lot of things that we within the industry are kind of like trying to ponder and figure out kind of like our next step forward, and maybe some of you out there can help us with that mission. I think it's important that, of course, we tune into you guys and what you all want to know about wine and are interested in, or how it can better serve you in your day-to-day. So we're going to get into some of that stuff today. Before we do, of course, a couple of very, very quick announcements. Be sure to like, subscribe, rate and review the show wherever you're consuming it. That's hugely helpful in letting it kind of get out there into the algorithm and making it easier for people to find. Can continue to share it with your wine-loving friends, family as well. You can follow us on all of our social networks on YouTube and Instagram, where we're most active, where you can find more regular updates about what actually is going in. And going on around the wine industry, our own labels, how our wines are made, all that fun kind of tasting notes, good stuff can be found on those two networks. You can also find us on the Book of Face and the social network formerly known as Twitter, where we repost all that stuff as well. If you prefer those networks, at MTGA Wines will be the handle. Be sure to head to our website, mtgawines.com. You can also check out the HBIC's wines at blairpaytonwines.com. You can sign up for our newsletters, check out our wine clubs, see what wines we currently have available, all that good stuff. Just be sure you're 21 years of age or older, because that's the law. All right, let's do this. So we're going to start with like a little bit of the mindset of this episode, because this is something that I love this time of year. It's a little funky. I'm going to get into why that is, but it's a little funky, but it gives me some downtime to really start kind of figuring out, you know, kind of the next steps forward. We missed an episode last week. We've been a little less active on social media over the last like 3 weeks or so. And that's very much on purpose to a certain extent. You know, after a crazy winter into, you know, travel schedule, typically by the second week of May, there's kind of this like slowdown. And as we get in June and July are actually our two slowest months out of the year, typically. Over the last like 3 years or so, there's a kind of our really slow time. And that kind of winding down for us starts by mid-May. And what's always interesting about this time of year and kind of how our mindset shifts and kind of where we're going, I think, you know, for us as a label, but also where this industry goes, is kind of like, okay, like what's next? For me, it's a little tough because I have time to listen to the voice inside my head, which is really annoying. It's nice being busy when you don't have to you're just going, right? You're just in the moment, going. And the second you have downtime, you have maybe too much time to think. And that's when I start to get like a little bit like feisty. The little bit of like the self-diagnosed like imposter syndrome kicks in of like, why do people want to do these wine events on the road? Why are people still a part of our wine club? This, that, and the other thing. Like you start really kind of like, oh my God, did this crazy last few months of being on the road and doing events and selling wine and all that, did all this like really happen? Why am I allowed to do this? Who is in charge of me? It's a weird time. It's what happens when it slows down for me is I kind of like, it's why you actually see me post a little bit less on social media as well. I get a little bit tired of seeing me like live vicariously through, you know, all of these random influencers or whatever. And it just gets annoying. And I'm like, I just can't do this anymore. I need a break. And I typically try and take that about this time. That typically happens like a couple times a year. And it's always after kind of our most busy seasons. So, you know, once we get into mid-May to like mid-June, it kind of slows down a little bit. And then again, right after harvest and kind of the stretch of November where we're traveling a lot, by the time we hit December, it's like we're slowing down. Like we're just going to take a little bit of a step back. It might mean we skip a week with the show here. Might mean you don't see as many posts on the social networks, but it's just a little like decompression so that we can start evaluating kind of the next steps forward. And I think that that's what a lot of us do in kind of what anyone does in like a crazy busy industry or time frame, where you get through that, you've achieved a lot, you're hopefully doing what you set out to do during that time frame, and now it's time to, you know, get back to kind of a 36,000 foot view and start evaluating like what's working, what's not, how are we looking for the rest, for the next quarter, the rest of the year, kind of are we going to make any changes, adjustments, and you go from there. And that's what I love about this downtime. It is a little feisty. I do have to like take a deep breath and try to relax and ignore the negative thoughts that kind of scroll through my brain. But outside of that, it's lovely. It's a lovely time. Now, this was kind of accentuated by an interesting kind of series of like an interview and podcast that I was listening to that actually had nothing to do with the world of wine. Some of you who I'm a big fan of like comedian stand-up comedy, I watch and listen to a lot of comedians' podcasts. And it's where, you know, I'm just looking for, it's kind of where I find a lot of my entertainment. I don't really watch a lot of TV outside of like sporting events. Like, you know, since the NHL playoffs are going on right now, like catching a lot of those. But realistically, I don't consume a lot of TV. It's a lot of other stuff, whether it's, you know, gaming, every, you know, video games in particular once in a while, or like listening to a great comedians like podcast. And the one I was listening to most recently, and what I've kind of gotten into more recently, is Tim Dillon. I don't know if anyone out there is familiar with him. I find him absolutely hilarious. Like any artist, you know, not everybody's cup of tea. But I really started tuning in because of a interview he did with a CNN correspondent. And it was just super, it was a super interesting conversation. And this, don't worry, this isn't going to go like some weird political way. But it was an amazing conversation because it was clear that the interviewer had certain, you know, thoughts or opinions on kind of where comedians are in this day and age and some of the podcasts that have gotten very, very popular, which is everyone. They mentioned people like Joe Rogan and Theo Von and people that are, you know, stand-up comedians kind of like first and foremost, but have like grown into these media personalities as well. And kind of what the opinion of like current or previous, like kind of what we, I guess they would call like the legacy media, I suppose, kind of think of them and how they're impacting society. And it was a very interesting conversation. And the reason I bring it up is, and I'll put links to both, you know, that interview as well as his podcast kind of talking about the interview, because they were just fascinating. If nothing else, just like interesting conversation pieces that I think were very applicable to like any industry, any conversation, because it obviously leaned a little bit more political, as you might expect, you know, in that interview. But what was really interesting to me and what I kind of took from it was that it was all about moving the conversation forward. Neither person, whether it was the comedian or the interviewer, were like trying to do like a gotcha. We're trying to, you know, push a certain like agenda necessarily or anything. It was like, here's just my opinion versus your opinion. Here's my view, you know, versus your view. Here's my experience versus your experience. And let's just get this out onto the table and see if we learn something from one another. And if we continue to, if we agree on something, great. If we disagree on something, fine. Like, this isn't any, you know, this isn't no, like a harm or foul. This is just a kind of where we're coming from, you know, from opposite, not even opposite corners, but just different corners, right? And I think the reason it kind of sunk in with me was because I started thinking about what is the wine industry doing to move the conversation forward? You know, because I'll be honest, we've talked, you know, I'm a little tired of talking about the doom and gloom of the wine industry, you know, the bankruptcies and the people's businesses that are in trouble. Like, we've covered that starting since last summer. It's been a full year of like, the grape market's a shit show, and Vintage Wine Estate went bankrupt, and RNDC is the second biggest distributor in the country is pulling out of California entirely, if you didn't see the news on that over the last like week or so. You know, it's just a mess. And I'm tired of, I think I got to a point now where I was a little tired of looking into the past and kind of reacting to the vibes and the drama and everything that was going on. I'm trying to figure out, okay, let's reframe this mindset. Let's stop focusing on, you know, kind of the negative voice, you know, during this downtime. Let's stop, you know, not, you can't ignore it. You know, you still want to listen and pay attention. You know, when we talk about how the wine industry is being impacted in a very negative way by, you know, kind of external forces, you know, it's probably worth paying attention to, even if it's a big business that you're looking at, because there might be something that you can relate to or some information that you can garner from this. Very similar to, you know, this interview with Tim Dillon, CNN. Like, it might be kind of opposing, you know, or opposite kind of forces. There's a really great article that Brittany forwarded me about kind of the term, you know, the wine industry, kind of quote unquote, and how it's kind of this broad, ambiguous thing, because what Gallo family does is very different than what, say, a small boutique producer like us. And I hate throwing out adjectives like that, but that's kind of the difference. When you're making like 90 million cases a year versus like 1,200 cases a year, that's a big difference. And realistically, even though we're a part of quote unquote the same industry, This is two completely different sports we're playing, right? But that doesn't mean that you can't sit down in a room with one person or another and garner some and have some sort of conversation about, you know, where you think wine is going, where you think distribution is going. And whether you agree or not is kind of irrelevant. What matters more is the fact that you're just having the conversation and getting stuff out onto the table and leaving with hopefully some knowledge, whether it be good or bad, right? You know, at least you're not living in an echo chamber is probably the biggest point, right? And that's why I love listening to this interview and the subsequent podcast that Tim Dillon put out, was because I'm like, this is something that I think I've mentioned on the show before, but when I have this like downtime, and I'm looking for kind of the next step forward and for our own business, or just kind of what I want to talk about here on the show, what I want the episodes to be and how we kind of move forward, I start looking outside the wine industry. And the reason for that, and kind of going back to like moving conversations forward, moving an industry forward, is this. I mean, the wine world is just rooted in such tradition. It's a very slow adopter of new technology. It hasn't really changed a whole lot, really, in centuries, outside of, hey, we use stainless steel and, you know, pumps and stuff now versus gravity and, you know, an amphora, you know, and whatnot. So, you know, like, things have changed, but the basics of the process really haven't. When it comes to sales and marketing, things really haven't changed that much. I mean, the direct-to-consumer side of things is a very, you know, new world thing. Wine clubs are still relatively new in the grand scheme of kind of the industry. Tasting rooms and hospitality is kind of the same thing, right? So there are new things that have happened, but those are all coming up on, you know, what, 20, 30 years of age? You know, there really hasn't been like any real, like realistically, like the biggest innovations are kind of coming from the lab companies and our understandings of like the chemistry and phenolics and compounds that make up the flavors and aromas that we love to enjoy, and how we can help accentuate some of this stuff, you know, whether it's through, you know, some of the additives and extracts we've talked about here on the show, or if you're just trying to, you know, put your fermentation in the best position possible during the harvest season. Like, there's a lot of those kinds of conversations, which are the very geeky science, you know, drill down to the nth degree. But I don't know if that's the next step, the big next step forward necessarily, right? Because, you know, from a winemaking or production standpoint, especially for the bigger guys that rely on a little bit more of kind of the enologist and lab techs and the science of winemaking, then yeah, that's going to help move that needle a little bit more, right? But for the smaller like boutique guys, what is really going to be the next thing? You know, Some of that technology, some of that science will certainly help us, no doubt about it. But that's just kind of internal. Again, that's kind of that echo chamber I'm talking about. You're just working within the confines of your industry in that sense. And what I'm a little worried about, I suppose, with how do we take this next step, is what does that mean for you guys, the consumers, the people that are enjoying our wines? You know, because realistically, that back-end stuff is stuff, unless you're a real wine geek, and I know some of you listening to this certainly are, and some of that stuff certainly can be fascinating, but is knowing, you know, what some of that those molecules do and how it accentuates certain things in your wine, is that really going to change your overall enjoyment of wine? Is getting to that nth degree of science and backbone of how this wine actually is on like a molecular level, is that really going to increase your overall enjoyment of wine? Is waxing poetically, you know, continuing to wax poetically about, you know, the barrels we use and production techniques and how we're small production and we focus on craft and yada, yada, yada. You know, there's a lot of the same conversations just kind of repeating themselves. There hasn't been really anything new to share with you guys. And that's kind of what, you know, this interview, oddly enough, brought me to. It was like, okay, you know, we're on our side of the table. And right now, it doesn't feel as though we've let consumers sit at the other side of the table. To a certain extent, maybe we have, because, you know, you guys speak with your dollars when you're buying wine out and about, with the wine clubs that you join, the allocation lists that you're a part of, the podcasts that you listen to, or the email, you know, the mailing lists that you're on. You kind of speak with your, you know, your actions. And when you see a trend like red blends or Pinot Noir kind of spike, then the industry reacts and says, hey, we should make more red blends and more Pinot Noir because people are really loving this right now. So let's supply them with what they want. And it's very reactionary. You know, there are certain points where the industry is being proactive, you know, where, you know, you'll see a producer make a different style or work with a different variety and kind of do something unique and interesting, kind of try and move that conversation in a different direction, whether it's forward or sideways or even backwards, I suppose. But there needs to be, I would think, a little bit more of a balance there, because both sides are kind of reacting to each other versus coming into a room and saying, and this is, you know, obviously kind of a metaphor here, but, you know, coming into a room and figuring out, like, what is it that you really want, right? And I think in more recent times, over the course of the last year, transparency has kind of been at that forefront, that more and more producers like us have wanted to come to the table and bring you guys to that table and say, hey, these are the things that really kind of separate like the craft wine projects from the you know, mass produced wine projects in terms of like additives and extracts and the amount of sugar that is in some of these wines, right? And that, you know, led into things like, hey, well, if that's the case, I mean, what wines, you know, does that apply to? And you saw, and we talked about the article, you know, out of, you know, from the San Francisco Chronicle regarding that wine shop in Kansas that, you know, started publishing, hey, here's how much sugar is in Meiomi compared to this other Pinot Noir that we're selling. I talked about this, you know, with a friend not a couple of weeks ago about, you know, The Prisoner, and that, you know, it's just, it's kind of, I think personally, it's a little bit of a shadow that once was, and but that happens when something's been, you know, changed hands multiple times, been blown up in terms of production. And my colleague's point was, well, it's still an entry-level wine that gets people into wine. And my argument there was, okay, well, do you really think $60 to $80 for a bottle of wine classifies as an entry-level wine for a new consumer? I would argue no. And I think that's where I see the most opportunity in moving this conversation forward, is right there. Is, I think Napa, for maybe a little too long, has lived in this echo chamber of, hey, we're going to produce these, you know, really high quality, really great wines. Certainly not the most affordable wines available out there. Let's be real here, right? You know, if you can find a Cabernet for somewhere between, you know, $60 and $75, it's a big deal. Typically looking, you know, at least $85 to $125, right? For kind of entry level Cabernet these days. So I think we need to come back as an industry and try and meet people where they are. And I think this was a question, part of the question during our May Q&A was like, who's doing it right now? And that's why this is another colleague and I were talking last night. We brought up Josh Phelps again and Grounded Wine Company of saying, hey, look, here's someone who's trying to, you know, it's not necessarily just Napa, because I think he does make a Napa cab, but it is like $75 a bottle. Again, probably good value for what it is. I don't think I've tried it off the top of my head, but I've liked his other wines. And some of his other wines are very, very affordable. And that's great. Trying to, again, kind of meet a lot of consumers, especially newer consumers to wine, where they are, where they're maybe not necessarily interested in spending $80 on a bottle of wine out the gate. It's probably going to behoove them to try a few things at a slightly more affordable price point. Because, you know, if you're really not that into wine, you don't want to spend a fortune on it to try to get into it necessarily, unless there's some, you know, intrinsic value to it that you're just hooked on, you know. And that certainly happens, you know, with certain things where it's like, oh, I just love the craftsmanship of it. I love the farming aspect. I love the, you know, the process. Like, you can certainly get hooked with to like all the other stuff and the stories involved, and that can draw you in, right? That can certainly be a part of it, I suppose. I mean, for me, it certainly is. But that's not everybody. Some people aren't necessarily going to want to be like the wine geek, right? They just want a good beverage. And their friends drink wine. They've been told it goes great with food, and they've enjoyed some wine with dinner before. And they're like, yeah, it'd be nice to have like a few bottles of wine around the house. But I don't want to break the bank doing it, right? And I think that's kind of where some of this conversation, I think that's where arguably a lot of the, you know, low-hanging fruit, pun intended, is for the wine industry, is trying to bring people in. And, you know, the transparency thing is obviously a big deal. It's gotten to be more and more of a big deal as kind of the last, you know, couple of years have gone on. I think that the value of wine when it comes to like what you would consider high quality versus low quality is an ambiguous thing, and it's so subjective that, yeah, you might not like, you know, any of the big name brands, but somebody does, otherwise they wouldn't be making millions of cases of it, right? The next step, and kind of where my mindset is, I suppose, with this, and this also kind of relates to, before I kind of move on to the next like little topic here, this is a little bit of a tangent, but this also kind of comes back to, I think, kind of the homogenization of a lot of wines and kind of the unbridled growth that the industry did see from realistically 2011 through, you know, 2023, 2022, right? You saw, I mean, like back out of 2020 with the fires out here specifically, but you saw nothing but growth. It was like, it just absolutely crazy how quick and easy it was to kind of like make money in the wine industry. And you saw people making everything from just real estate plays out here to starting their own brands. And you saw the market just continue to inflate. And as a result, we've kind of entered this deflationary period, right? And quite frankly, when it comes to Napa, I mentioned this earlier, we got a little big for our britches. And you see people now trying to rectify that. The problem is there's just so much supply and just not nearly enough demand. You're seeing producers that, you know, clearly got out over their skis, i.e. a vintage wine estate that went bankrupt. The articles that have come out about Lawrence Family more recently and kind of the tough times they may or may not be in. you're seeing wines from very high-end producers that typically start at $1.50 a bottle that you can find online through places like Wine Access or Last Bottle or whatever the case, insert flash sale site here, that used to be $150, $175 a bottle that you can now get for somewhere between $40 and $60. Because people are just hurting, they need cash flow, and they're willing to take it any way they can get it right now. You have people, if you look at the grape report that we went through back in February, March, or whatever it was, where you see people spending tens of thousands of dollars on a ton, one ton of Cabernet to make two barrels of it, when the average price is like $9,000. But people are paying $20,000, $25,000, $30,000, up to $60,000 or more for a ton of Cabernet. It's like, this is what's unsustainable, and this is what I have an issue with. Personally, I have a bone to pick with all that. Two, what did you think was going to happen? Like at a certain point, you're going to hit a ceiling of some sort because you're continuing to just dictate to people. And at a certain point, consumers probably don't want to be told what they should like. They want to figure it out for themselves. And that's, for me, where this conversation moves forward, is helping you guys, whether you're a veteran and you've been to Napa a bunch and you know what you like, but you're willing to explore new things, or you're someone new and you've enjoyed wine before. It's a beautiful place. You've heard there's great spas and activities to do here. So you come on out and you experience Napa for the first time. We need to be able to meet people where they are. And right now, I don't think Napa in particular has done a good enough job of doing that. And I think there are a lot of people with some of the conversations we've been having, you know, within the industry and what has started to kind of creep out into the world, especially when it comes to, again, transparency, additives, and so on and so forth, that we're getting better, but we're still not doing the best job of meeting people where they are and getting people to that proverbial table we've been talking about in that interview that I mentioned, to have the conversations and figure out what it is people really want. You know, I think, quite frankly, this is why you see a lot of wine businesses in trouble right now, is you saw them just taking shots in the dark. We're going to buy this piece of land, or we're going to hire this consulting winemaker, or we're going to invest all this money to revamp our image or that image, and we're just going to run with it. It's just kind of blind faith. Like, let's just go in a way that we think is forward. Key word there, think, right? And I believe there are quite a few people kind of regretting that decision. Or, you know, there's just too much pride involved and they're like, well, this is what we do. This is who we are. So we're just going to keep banging our head against the wall. And maybe there's an owner behind it or owners behind it where money is no object. So, you know, this brand hasn't been profitable before. So why start now? That's certainly a thing. That's certainly a thing, right? And then you see, you know, layoffs happen and you see, you know, people lose jobs because they're frustrated and budgets need to be cut. And, you know, realistically, that business is no better off than it was the day before. But maybe you can cut, you know, maybe you can cut your payroll a little bit. Operate on a skeleton crew for a year or so. And then as things rebound a little bit, you can start rehiring and fill in some spots yet again. I don't know. I think this way forward is going to be the biggest topic of conversation. I mean, it already is within the industry, but again, I think it's too many people within the world of wine talking to each other and not getting out there and trying to figure out, you know, where people are and what you need. Because, you know, this was all anecdotal based on my market visits, and like the opinion of Napa out around the country right now doesn't seem to be that great. Like the people that love Napa wine and know you know, who the, you know, quote unquote, like good producers are, you know, and the stuff that they love. Obviously, it's a little bit different because they've fallen in love with the wines, the people, you know, the brand as a result, and they're all in, right? Those companies met those people where they were looking for what they needed from, you know, smaller boutique, insert fancy adjective here to describe those brands. And they're like, this is what I, from a wine producer in Napa, this is what I want. I don't want to go to the grocery store and see it on the shelf necessarily. If I do, that's fine, but, you know, probably not the place I want to see it. I want to know the people that are actually doing the work. I want to know, you know, that's what's great about a lot of these places in Napa, is you get to meet and interact with people that are intimately involved with how these wines are made versus, you know, trying to figure out who actually made Apothic Red this year, right? It's a little tougher to have a relationship with some of these larger brands because they're just brands. There's not necessarily a face or a person behind it. It's just a brand name, right? I think I mentioned this story previously where, and this is, again, this kind of ties into this of like, where, how are you moving forward? Like what, like, where do you want your company, your brand to be? How are you going to meet consumers where they are? And I mentioned this about, a good friend of mine at a company he works for, his owner. I've probably told this story, but you're going to hear it again because I love giving this an example. Is this his owner? You know, he's been losing money on this wine project out here for like a decade and a half. It's one of those, like, money's no object. He's done very well for himself, very passionate about wine, and loves that his wife and he are now involved in this beautiful industry, but they've been losing money hand over fist for 15 years, right? And, or maybe something, it was more than a decade, that's for sure. Anyway, he wanted to be, like, his favorite wine in the world was Colgan. Colgan was his thing, which obviously makes good wine, known for making good juice, right? And he wanted to be the next Colgan. And my question, it's still to this day, was, do you want to be the next Colgan or the first you? Right? What are you going to do to move, take that ball and run with it? Because obviously that's a great benchmark. That's a killer competitive set to have if that's where you're trying to go with your business. But what are you, like, how are you going to separate yourself? How are you going to move that forward? What about that conversation and your story and who you are and what you want to be doing within this world of wine? Like, how are you moving forward? And again, I think this is where so many producers have ended up, is they saw kind of this, you know, overarching, like, hey, make big Napa Cab, sell a bunch of it, make money over the last 14 years. So a lot of people jumped on board. It turns out it's a lot harder to do that, like, easier said than done. And you have a lot of brands that are now struggling because they lived in that echo chamber of, we just want to be the next big thing, whatever that thing is. Again, kind of insert competitive set here. This is where, like, any client that I've taken on like a consulting basis, I'm like, I can help make pretty good wine for you. I think. I like to think I'm pretty good at what I do. But I'm going to be involved in something. Let's make sure that it actually has some sort of background, backstory, something unique that your people that you're trying to entice into buying this wine has. Like, give me something on, like, the creative side to work off of. Because if I'm just making good wine to make good wine, I mean, you can hire anybody to do that. You know, if you're really trying to create something unique and special, and we're going to have more of a, not just a winemaking conversation, but a creative conversation about how we're moving this forward in a way, how we're taking this torch and running with it, rather than let's just make red wine for the sake of making red wine, right? This is why I think tried to talk so much about kind of maybe some of the drama in the industry and additives and sugar in wine and stuff like that. This is why I've brought a lot of this stuff up, because, you know, over the last year, these have been the things that have been hot topics. These have been the things that are like, how do we move this conversation forward? What has like the biggest head of steam and the most potential to connect with you guys? And I don't think we're done with those conversations. We'll certainly revisit them. We'll talk a lot more about the wine business and how things are shaken out from, you know, a grape growing perspective to a winemaking perspective and all this other good stuff. Like, we'll continue having these conversations here on this show, out at the winery, at events around the country, we'll keep doing what we're doing. But now that we've been having these conversations for going on a year or more, it's time to start tackling some of the other stuff. And do I think that this industry needs like a full like revamp? No. I think this is like the, you know, X amount of mileage checkup. You know, let's change the oil. Let's, you know, get a good tune up, check the brakes, make sure your fluids are, you know, nice and fresh. Like, this is just like, we need to zhuzh things up a little bit and make sure that we're not just blindly marching forward for the sake of what we think is forward. It's time to actually sit back and maybe listen a little bit and see where we can actually meet people and what's, you know, really reasonable, you know, because I know there are some folks out there that are like, hey, I remember when Napa Cab was like $40 a bottle. I'm like, that's great. So do I. That is not a thing anymore. There are certain things that we probably just won't be able to get back to. But there are certainly ways forward that the world of wine can make it more approachable, more enjoyable, and more interesting. And hopefully, we can have these conversations and meet people in the middle somewhere. I can give you a great example. To kind of close out the show here, I'll give you a great example. We had a client of ours who I hadn't seen in like 5 years or so, since actually probably like 6 or 7 years, because it was pre-COVID the last time they were out. Sat down in the tasting with them, and we had the shipping conversation. Hates paying for shipping. If there's a shipping charge, I simply won't buy the wine. Okay, fair enough. No harm, no foul. I get that. No one likes paying for shipping. Amazon Prime is a thing. Granted, we're not Amazon Prime, right? And the biggest pet peeve, though, was, you know, this individual didn't know. It's like, hey, I get charged $60 from one person. I get charged $90 from this person. But if I order through a flash sale site, actually Wine Access is the example he gave, you know, they'll sell me a thing that's like 50% off, 60% off. And if I buy a case, they'll comp the shipping on top of that. And I'm like, okay, well, here's how that works. Let me, you're at the table. Let's have this conversation. And I hope I wasn't too overwhelming about this, but it was like, okay, so shipping, whether you like it or not, is about $90 to get it across the country. Okay? Doesn't matter who you are. It's about $90 to get it across the country. So if you're getting, you know, half off that wine and they're comping, say, a $90 shipping charge, they've probably factored that into their margin and they're just eating the shipping cost. Right? If another winery says, hey, we're going to do a flat rate for $30 on a case, they're eating the other 60. And we had a great conversation. He said, oh, that's how that works. I said, yeah, the shipping's not any cheaper. They're still getting charged the same amount from the common carrier that probably anyone else is. There are going to be small variations depending on maybe the fulfillment house and how much business they actually do through them. But the rates have equalized pretty well across the industry. Some places might be a hair more expensive here or there, or a hair cheaper here or there. It's not a big enough of a difference for you to cause a fuss, realistically. But what happens is, if someone's giving you a flat rate, they're eating the other portion that you don't see. And that's what much of the industry doesn't communicate. And I was like, well, you should thank them. If they're giving you, like, a Wine Access is a great example. If they're discounting this wine X amount and they're giving you, you know, comp shipping, that means their margins are super thin. And hopefully, you know, everyone's buying enough wine to make it make sense. It seems like they do all right. I don't obviously No, but it's, you know, great business model, right? Give a great deal, comp the shipping, just sell a bunch of it. And if our net profit per bottle is $2, but we sell a million bottles, $2 million of profit, I'd take that to the bank. That'd be great. I'm not saying that's what they do, but, you know, the math's pretty easy if when you start breaking it down like that, right? So it's stuff like that. It's just being communicative. It's trying to say, hey, this person, this individual is clearly frustrated about shipping. This is an issue that he despises. Can someone in the industry come to them and say, like, hey, let me break this down for you. Let's have this conversation. You might not agree with it. You might not agree or even like my answer, but this is the reality. And we can move on from there. Yeah. So that's the kind of that's a very small, very tiny anecdotal example. But that's the kind of stuff that we can do, I think, as an industry that hopefully just give you guys more confidence in who we are, what we do, and what we're about. And I hope you guys check out that. I don't care, like, politics aside, it's an interesting conversation between this CNN person, and I can't even remember her name. I probably should have looked that up. And Tim Dillon, definitely check out his podcast as well if you're into comedians. If you're offended by anything he says, remember, he's a comedian and it's not my fault. Just remember that. I have a very dry, sarcastic, pretty dark sense of humor. Not saying that he's that way, but, you know, I laugh at just about everything. I'm impossible to offend. There might be a little bit of a groan with certain jokes, but, you know, I might still find it funny. All right. Thank you all so much for tuning in. I think this is a great next step for how we're going to continue talking about the world of wine, whether it's little issues like shipping or it's things about grape contracts and the, you know, business, or maybe some of those geeky details when it comes to, you know, some of these labs and the science kind of behind winemaking. We're going to continue tackling everything, of course, but for a little bit, we're really going to continue kind of looking forward and trying to key into things that will help connect you guys to this world of wine. And of course, as usual, if you have any questions, thoughts, suggestions, we can tackle those during our monthly Q&A episode. Heard it here first. We'll be doing that at the end of June, just like we did at the end of May. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. Be sure again to like, subscribe, rate, and review the show here. Share it with your wine-loving friends and family. Follow us on our social networks, especially YouTube and Instagram at MTGA Wines, though you can also find us on the Book of Face and the social network formerly known as Twitter. Go to our website, mtgawines.com. Go to blairpaytonwines.com. Sign up for our newsletters. Go check out what wines we have available. Be 21 years of age or older. And we will see you next week here on the Wind Up Podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Cheers.